The scripture reading this morning will come from Romans chapter 7, beginning in verse 15. Romans chapter 7, beginning in verse 15. For what am I doing? I do not understand. For what I will to do, that I do not practice. But what I hate, that I do. If then I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that it is good. But now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. For I know that in me, that is, in my flesh, nothing good dwells. For to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good I do not find. For the good that I will to do, I do not do. But the evil I will not to do, that I practice. Now, if I do what I will not to do, it is no longer I who do it, but the sin that dwells in me.
I don't know whether the Apostle Paul, in that relatively painful and personal statement that Brad just read for us in Romans chapter 7, is just talking about sin in general, or whether he's referring to some specific sin, some specific temptation of his own. I do know that when he cries out at the end of that chapter, by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, "Who will free me from this body of death, O wretched man that I am," that he speaks for many people who face their own personal temptations and face their own personal kinds of sins that lead to a kind of a lack of control over which they despair, trying many times, of course, to escape and yet remain addicted by whatever kind of particular sin or temptation they are prone to. And of course, we've all long known about the addictive powers of certain kinds of drugs. The scriptures itself, in three occasions, specifically when talking about elders, as in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 3, says, "Not addicted to wine." And the addiction that occurs to alcohol and to other kinds of drugs is certainly destructive in our society today and deserves pointing out and attention. But an even greater, more widespread danger, I think, if not greater, more widespread, is that we're learning that certain kinds of activities, such as gaming and online shopping and excessive use of social media, can become just as problematic for many people, even to the point of being called addictive. I mean, we're so inundated with online activities today that we almost forget that just 25 years ago there was no such thing as a widely available internet to the public, and that just 15 years ago there were no such things as smartphones. Recently as 2012, only a third of Americans owned those kinds of devices that were connected continually to the internet. Today more than two-thirds do, and if we look at those who were considered young adults, 90% of them are continually connected to the internet. And one of the things that we find is that that kind of connection creates various sorts of problems, problems that rise to the level that some have called it addiction. A Pew survey just last year indicated that 46% of Americans said that they could not live without their smartphone. And that's a problem not only for the general public, that's a problem for Christians as well. Desiring God survey in the about the same period of time asked a Christian group, a religious group, Bible-believing group, a relatively large, widespread survey, and asked them that question. And 38% of them said that they had an uncontrolled and unhealthy interaction with their cell phone, checking their social networks compulsively throughout the day. And they knew it was not good for them, but they had little control over that. It is amazing how much that has become a part of our lives and how powerful it has become in controlling our lives. There have been books about internet addiction around for the last 20 years. That is from the very moment at which we became widely aware of the internet and how we could be connected to it in our society. And that's not surprising, of course, because any new technology, any new kind of fad is almost always demonized initially. But the number of books that continue to be written about the problematic use of the internet suggests that that was not really just some kind of a strange outburst at the beginning, that it is a problem in America. And one of the things that is clear about it is that it is so constantly with us. You know, if we had to go sit down at a desk and had a computer and turn it on and wait for it to crank up with a hard drive, then that would be one thing. But a device that travels with you in your pocket or in your purse and is constantly available is a better vehicle for addiction than almost any other form of addiction that we know. Convenience weaponizes this kind of temptation. It is constantly with us. And even worse than the problem of convenience is that our use of the internet is deliberately designed by the purveyors of digital content to keep us using it. And you may remember this old adage, if it's free, then you're the product. Because it depends upon our constant use of those free online sources like the social media. Their profit depends upon us coming back time and time again. And they know how to keep us doing that. A recent book was entitled, They Know What Buttons to Push and They Will Keep Pushing Them. There is, of course, a widespread concern in our society about online gaming, internet gaming. A recent kind of outburst of concern over Fortnite. And rightly so, but the adults who decry their children's addiction to those kind of games may very well look at their own use of social media and other online kind of content. We have a disorder in the DSM-5 called the Internet Addiction Disorder. Interestingly, back in 1995, that phrase was first used by Dr. Goldberg in a satirical article about how people were going to become addicted to the internet. Since then, we've begun to take that a lot more seriously in the DSM-5, though it does not list it as an official disorder, has it in the appendix as one of those kind of disorders we need to pay attention to. And in fact, the numbers are suggestive that we really need to be concerned about that. 8.2% of the general population, by the criteria they currently use, would be diagnosed as addicted to the internet. 8.2%, that's millions of people. And that's a larger category of disorder, of problematic behavior, than any other of the categories within the DSM-5, except for anxiety or depression. And the problem may be bigger than that, because some reports suggest that it might be as high as 30%. Nearly a third of Americans who have problematic use of the internet, whether it rises to the level of addiction or not. And of course, that's always difficult when we start using words like addiction. Do we mean that it is so abnormal that we deserve to point it out and say, this is a disorder, this person is addicted, or is it just normal behavior that's become exaggerated? And of course, that's the difficulty with any kind of diagnosis. Whether we're talking about anxiety or depression, that's part of everybody's life to some extent. Impulsive behavior is a part of everybody's life to a certain extent. When does it become abnormal enough that it becomes problematic enough that we call it an addiction? Well, it's pretty clear that there are many people today who do have a problem with controlling their use of the internet. And it is similar to any other impulse control disorder like gambling or even like use of various kinds of addictive drugs. And it takes a variety of forms. Sometimes this internet addiction disorder is involved with compulsive gaming, as with the Fortnite. Sometimes it's involved with compulsive shopping, You know, we always worried about that when we went into the grocery stores and there were those items lined up just before you went into the checkout counter, and they knew which ones to put there that they might entice people to buy that maybe they didn't need. It's even worse when ads prop up on your smart device to suggest this is what you need. And how many of you have observed this? You had a conversation with somebody and then there's the advertisement for it. They know, probably they're not listening to every conversation you have, but they know which buttons to push and they're going to keep pushing them. Or it may be an addiction to social media just to check in and see what's happening with the increasing group of friends that we have to pay attention to. And the problem with an internet addiction disorder or problematic use of the internet is not just the content, but it's the methodology itself. It's the medium itself. It is designed to be addictive. It's not just another box to put stuff in and search through. You know, if it was a box and we had to pull it off the shelf and look in there, that'd be one thing. If we had to go to the problem of looking up a phone number and dialing it to talk to people, that would be one thing. But is the instant availability. It is just a finger press away, and we find that kind of content. And it requires very little attention to decide whether we're pleased with that content and whether we want to move on to the next or not. And the variable pleasure that we get from that, pressing, scrolling, delete this one, like this one, move to the next one, or buy this, or add this to the cart, that is designed to keep us engaged in that kind of activity. It is like a drug in some ways. The neurological reward that we get from pressing on the screen or swiping on the screen and making things happen instantaneously produces a little surge of dopamine in the pleasure centers of the brain and creates a need to come back and get that kind of pleasure again. Now, of course, you know, the big question is, are we just talking about normal behavior? Are we talking about normal behavior that's a little bit of a problem? Or are we talking about addictive behavior? I mean, I think most people recognize the need to control whatever kind of behavior they're engaging in life, including their use of the internet, whether it's social media or whether it's shopping or whether it's gaming, or maybe even some of the worst kind of forms of the dark side of the internet. But does it warrant calling it addiction? Well, as one of the writers in this area says, doesn't matter what we call it, you've got a problem and you need to do something about it, whether it's an addiction or not. But one of the things that we look at is it's kind of like an addiction, because withdrawal and tolerance symptoms. I mean, one of the things we notice about drug dependency or about compulsive gambling is that when people don't do it, they experience various kind of negative sorts of symptoms, anger, tension, depression. When people don't get to use the internet, they experience those same kind of symptoms. Maybe they call it boredom, or there's a sense of joylessness in life, or there's moodiness or nervousness or irritability, but they need more of what they have been getting. And in fact, one of the other characteristics of an addiction is a need for more and more and more. Tolerance is the hallmark of alcohol and drug addiction and seems to be applicable to our internet use as well. That the more we do, the more we want to do. Well, we might say that about fishing too, right, Joe? The more you fish, the more you want to fish. But there's something different about that kind of real life activity and the virtual activity that we engage in online. These neurological factors in our brain engage with this kind of easy, quick access and change the way we interact with the world. And it's pretty clear that extensive use of the internet changes the brain, reducing gray matter in the prefrontal cortex by as much as 10 or 20%. And that's where we engage in making judgments about the world. Now, that's not the whole way in which we make judgments, and it's not the whole story about our moral compass. But it certainly seems to be related to that. There are also cognitive behavioral explanations of why using online sources is so problematic for us. One is the way in which we're rewarded. If you want to build a habit into a child, you have to reward them every time they do it. Every time they brush their teeth, you got to remind them, you got to reward them. But if you just do it every time, then if you quit doing it, they're likely going to quit. So you kind of space it out. You reward them every other time, or every three or four times, randomly, and you make it longer and longer. Pretty soon it's a habit. And they can't help themselves. They have to brush their teeth or floss after every meal. That's exactly the way the internet works. When we go online and we click, maybe we get exciting news that we were looking for. Maybe the next click. Maybe the next click. And oh, there it is. It's like, you know, we go online and all of a sudden somebody has had a new baby. And it's like, oh, that's wonderful news. Or maybe even worse than that, somebody we've always been a little suspicious of is divorced. Aha! That's exciting. Or we scroll, nope, but you keep going, and then boom, there it is again. That kind of reinforcement is the fundamental basis of addictive behavior, certainly like gambling, certainly like internet use. And you see the kind of problems that it creates in our lives. Anxiety, depression, these are comorbid with any of these kinds of addictions. Beard suggests these diagnostic criteria that have been listed in the DSM-5. Person is preoccupied with the internet, constantly thinks about what they're going to find, what they have found in the past. They need to be on the internet, spending increased amounts of time, whatever the activity is, whether it's social media or whether it's gaming or whether it's shopping or just checking to see if maybe there's a deal available. A person who has tried to unsuccessfully to limit the amount of time that they spend online, or they become moodier, irritable, or restless when they are not online, and they stay online longer than they originally intended. Now, I'll tell you the truth, that's probably some of those things true of every single person here, and we wouldn't say that they were addicted, or even that it was problematic. So we add a further set of categories. Those things are always true, people who have problematic use of the internet. But one of these things true? Here's where it gets to be kind of serious. Has jeopardized or risked the loss of a significant relationship or job or educational opportunity as a result of internet use. Now, we recognize how problematic that is. And we're talking about 8% of the population, or maybe more than that. Two, does it lead to concealing from other people the extent to which we use the internet, even to the point of lying about it? That's problematic. Or do people use the internet to escape from their problems, to relieve their anxiety, their feelings of guilt or helplessness? There's nothing more powerful. Going online, and you can make it happen. Whether it's a gaming experience or whether it is just moving from one site to the other and finding what you want to see or to read or to hear, the opinion that supports yours. You know, and the consequences of this are pretty significant socially. One of the significant negative effects of internet problematic internet use is that our real relationships begin to suffer or be neglected. Social media is a great tool for supplementing relationships, but it's a terrible tool to start them or to build them. And here's a rule of thumb that some writers suggest about this. If you've not met the person face to face, then that's not your friend. I was always amazed when we started looking, and you know, I have a Facebook account, and you know, students, they will say, will you be my friend? Will you be my friend? So I've got, yeah, like most people, you know, a bunch of friends. I usually don't agree to be friends unless it's somebody that I've absolutely met face to face. But even so, I don't know those people. And I was always puzzled about that because my dad always used to say, following after Aristotle, whom he never, I don't think he ever spoke the word Aristotle in his life, but he and Aristotle both saw it this way. If you've got two or three friends in your life, you're blessed. Two or three good friends. Well, you know, when we have 100, 300, 1,000 friends, those are not friends. Not unless we have personal interactions with them. The very nature of the technology is aversive to social relationships. It is the most socially connecting technology we've ever had, but it's also socially isolating. We sit there in our own privacy, our own anonymity, and we create these relationships with other people who are also there in their privacy and their anonymity. And one of the things it does for us is it creates a difficulty of knowing who we are. It's a process by which we construct a performance for the audience. And the potential audience is like incredible. I mean, you think about this. You have 300 friends on Facebook. Each of your 300 friends has 300 friends. That's 90,000 people. Well, of course, they're all interconnected, so let's just, whittle that away. Even if 90% of those people are connected to one another, you still probably have 9,000 people that are looking at your performance, liking or ignoring your opinions or your post. That's an audience that would have been impossible for anybody except the most popular movie stars or musicians or politicians up until just recently. Now we all have that kind of audience out there that is observing our performance. And how do we know who we are except the way in which we present ourselves to other people? And when they like or they don't like, and we make adjustments about what we post or don't post in order to fit those likes or to maximize those likes, that becomes a part of our identity. That becomes part of who we are. Our sense of self becomes dependent upon these incessant feedback patterns. And we become overwhelmed and confused about who we really are. You know, here's one of the amazing things. Instead of living inside our head and experiencing the world in the way in which most people did for all of history, now we're on the outside observing ourselves and not really participating, but measuring our performance as to who we are. That has enormous consequences for the way in which we conceive of ourselves and the way in which we conceive of our relationship with other people. Now, I guarantee you there are people like Bill Gates who are going to say, you know, this is not worse, this is better. It's just a new way, maybe, of interacting. But somehow it seems fundamentally wrong to me that instead of actually participating in life and being a part of it, that we have more and more stepping outside of ourselves to see our performance. Counselors who deal with this kind of problem very frequently ask their patients, are you living the life you want to live, or are you living the life that other people around you want you to live? That goes back to Socrates, by the way, but still fundamentally the same case. You know, are we an integrated person, or have we given that up and given up control over who we are to this kind of technology? Really, for our concerns here, it's much more than social. It's spiritual. And, of course, one of the negative impacts right away on a Christian's life is that it takes up a lot of time. And the time that it takes up leaves us less time for meditation and prayer and Bible study. And, in fact, one of the things that it does, too, is if we had the time, if we were to sit in a darkened room, you know, we sing that song, sitting in the evening and whiling away the days, the hours, and, you know, dreaming of the time to come. You know, do you see people sitting on their porch in the afternoons and just letting, you know, we don't have time for that. I understand that. If I'm not busy doing something, then I'm really waste time. But here's a problem. We don't have any patience for empty spaces in our lives. And yet, in some ways, that's where spiritual activity is supposed to take place. The first requirement for prayer is silence. Mother Teresa said, people of prayer are people of silence. And of course, she's no great authority, but it was the psalmist who first said, was it not? And much better, in Psalm 46 and verse 10, be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am God. Ours, the New American Standard Version has it, cease striving. You got to quit. You got to give up in order to make a connection with God, in order to meditate, in order to pray. Other writers have suggested that this digital revolution has made available to us and has exaggerated a spiritual problem that has really devastated the churches. Of course, he's not a member of our fellowship, but one of the things that we recognize, I think, if we have ever talked to anybody who attend services, and maybe even some who are members of the Church of Christ, is the sense that we have to have some kind of activity going on all the time. That the kind of quietude that always in the past was associated with worship seems to get lost in the contemporary worship services that emphasize some kind of frantic sort of activity with no place for being silent or being quiet. And this constant busyness and bustle is disastrous to the concept of actual connecting with God, with having space for silence and stillness and meditation. That's what's conducive to prayer and meeting the Lord God. And we end up, you know, when we are on the internet, it's like here's this and here's that and here's the other, and we sort through all of that stuff. I'm always thinking about one of those movies in which they have changed it from on the screen till they put it up on the holograph, you know, and you push it aside here and you pull this down and you expand that and there it is. Now, I mean, that creates a very different view of life that's not integrated. It's all atomatized. It's all separated. And there are no filters, you know. It's just we move this and make this bigger. Whether it's really bigger in the world or not, we make it bigger and we pull it around and push this apart and separate this stuff. That's not the way life is. And yet that's the way it seems when we spend a lot of time online. And one click leads you to humor and another one leads you to pathos and another one leads you to sarcasm. Another one leads you to some kind of real profound statement. And yet it's all the same. And then we move on as rapidly as possible. And, you know, we think there's some kind of filter because we follow certain kind of people and we only accept certain kinds of friends and we only go to certain kind of sites. But here's the truth of the matter. Back behind all of that, those computer algorithms that are filtering stuff for you and making decisions for you about what you're going to see and breaking the world into these disconnected, incoherent parts, that doesn't lead to having a settled worldview. And if we don't have a settled worldview that is biblical, then we're not biblical and we're not spiritual as we ought to be. And we have some kind of dispersed consciousness where we're not even whole and integrated ourselves. We have these little bits and pieces that are scattered everywhere. And the use of the internet produces carnal attitudes and behaviors. You know, one of the things that we most have to guard against, I think, in using social media is the posturing and the self-aggrandizement that goes on constantly. Some media are worse than others. Generally, the studies indicate things like Instagram are even worse than things like Facebook. But what we have are people that are filled with all these posts that are filled with all these happy selfies, these accounts of success, these accounts of accomplishments, and we need to present that as well when we're online. Being Christian doesn't necessarily mean an easy life. And presenting ourselves as if we've been successful, sharing, and of course, you know, that's great with our real friends. We certainly want to share our accomplishments and our successes and our blessings. We want to share with them as well, you know, our heartaches and our difficulties and our temptations. Confess your sins one to another. But doing that online changes and distorts the whole relationship. You know, the world does not need to see the fact that Christians are presenting themselves as having a happy, easy life. That's just not the way the Bible teaches it. If the world hated me first, the world's going to hate you. And, you know, and in fact, when Christians go online, and this is not just Christians, it's everybody, when we go online and we attempt to demonstrate some kind of virtues, they get distorted in some way. There's always like the humble bragging that goes on. I'm so blessed that my latest video went viral. Hashtag humbled, hashtag blessed, hashtag Christian. It's like, come on, do you not see what you're doing to yourself with that kind of a post? Showing off your virtues online looks a lot like the hypocrites that Jesus condemned in Matthew chapter 6. When you pray, don't be like the hypocrites. They stand and they pray in the synagogues and the street corners that they may be seen by others. And then there's the other thing where we see the post and says, I really need to limit my time online. And so I'm going to go on a media fast, a Facebook fast. It's like, isn't that what he warned about? Do not paint your faces and tell everybody, I'm on a fast. And, you know, this like, if you need to contact me, use email, or better still, write me a letter. As if you want, think people want to contact you because you're going on a fast and compliment you about that. Humble bragging. And then, of course, the fact that you're on the internet puts you in connection with all kinds of people who have all kind of influence on you. 1 Corinthians 15:33 is as true on the media as it is in real life. Evil companions corrupt good morals. And I know we want to do good, because here's the temptation. You get so tired of the same lame arguments and you want to shoot them down with a vengeance. Then you're convinced that your witty one-liner is clever enough to end all argument about that. Well, it won't. I can assure you that an argument has never been won on social media, but in our efforts to score the final point, we end up becoming arrogant and snide in the same way as those people we so dislike in their posting. And of course, there's plenty of opportunity online using the internet to plant seeds and to spread the word, but there's very little opportunity for actually harvesting that, for bringing it to fruition. Facebook theology and apologetics debates are probably stimulating, but one word from a Christian, genuinely spoken face to face about the gospel, has got to be worth more than 140 tweets, 1,400 tweets. I don't know. Maybe there are no tweets that actually accomplish anything spiritual. I don't know. But we need to be doing the face to face work as it has always been done. You know, making connection with people, setting up a Bible study, going to their house, or, engaging in a correspondence course. You know, that's a great use of the internet. But just tweeting about it, you know, short, pithy posts are not going to get the gospel taught. And, of course, there are other difficulties, too. Internet shopping, gambling lead to all kind of financial woes. We can understand about that. And even worse, the dark side, where people end up involved in, you know, pornographic interactions that are just clearly sinful. And yet, you know, you get led on step by step by step. And it's harder to make a distinction online than it is in real life. The Bible says some things, I think, that are useful to this, although the Bible nowhere I could find mentions internet, virtual reality, or Facebook. But Ephesians chapter 5, I think a passage we would recognize is applicable here. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 18, do not get drunk with wine, for that's dissipation. No addiction, whether it's wine, or whether it's gambling, or whether it is internet activities, that's dissipation. Be filled, though, with the Spirit, and speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs and sing, and make melody with your hearts to the Lord, always giving thanks for all things in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. And that suggests three solutions, I think, for this problem. One, be filled with the Spirit. As opposed to being filled up with the things of the world, things that are carnal, be filled with the Spirit. That is, study the Word, pray, and have a connection with God. Two, seek a spiritual companionship. Spend time and build relationships with Christians, face-to-face personal relationships. And once again, If you have a connection with somebody face-to-face in the real world, you can certainly use social media as a means of staying in touch with them and building that relationship. But it has to be refurbished, I think, by face-to-face interactions. It can't just depend upon that kind of virtual sort of interaction. That's why in Hebrews we're reminded, forsake not the assembling of yourselves together. Yeah, and you just think about that. Suppose that we decided, yeah, we probably could just, instead of all having to travel every day and waste all that time and come together, we could just do it virtually. You know, we could have video conferencing services. Nah, that's not going to get it done. Forsake not the assembling of yourselves together. We need to seek real relationships and not just superficial online ones. And third, this passage in Ephesians chapter 5 suggests gratitude toward God. An attitude of gratitude is one of the greatest sources of mental health and happiness that there is. Grateful people don't complain. Grateful people don't grow angry easily or seek out selfish, self-aggrandizing activities. Grateful people are more likely to be productive and unselfish and helpful to others. And of course, all of that requires self-control, which is one of the fruits of the Spirit. You remember in Galatians chapter 5, verse 23, we're supposed to have meekness and temperance. Another translation that is continence. And the opposite of continence is incontinence, an inability to control our behavior. And that's exactly what the producers of Facebook content want to happen, our internet content want to happen. They want you coming back constantly all the time because you are the product. And we need to control what is in our minds, in our thoughts, in our hearts. Instead of letting some computer algorithm or people that we have only a virtual connection with constantly inundating us with these ideas and filling our heart and our mind up with the things that they think are important in the ways they think are important, we need to take control of that. Proverbs chapter 4 and verse 20. And the book of Proverbs has so much wisdom in it. Father speaking to his son, the same kind of, son, listen to me. I'm telling you, I know that you're impatient with me about this, but listen to me. Proverbs 4 and verse 20, my son, give attention to my words. Incline your ear to my sayings and do not let them depart from your sight, and keep them in the midst of your heart, for they are life to those who find them and health to all their body. Watch over your heart with all diligence, for from it spring the issues of life. And of course, previous generations had to contend with this kind of inundation of information from television and theater, you know, and the newspapers. But we have such a much greater barrage of ideas and philosophies being thrown at us online, and all of it in the context of this sort of medium that just urges us to go from one thing to the other without really processing it or ever thinking about it. That's far worse than anything that our parents or grandparents ever experienced. And the content is far worse, too. I mean, here's what happens. You know, you see it over and over again. Something productive online, and that leads you to link to something else that's just a little more humorous, and here's another humorous one, and then the next thing you're looking at something you know you have no business looking at. And of course, if you're in a room with other people, it's like, get rid of that immediately. If you're private, anonymous, as we so often are, it's like, let's just see what it's all about. And all of a sudden, our minds are filled with things that they are better not to have known about. There are things they do in the dark, Paul said, of which we ought not to even speak. Philippians 4 and verse 8. Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute. If there's any excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, then dwell on these things. True, not false. Noble, not base. Right, not wrong. Pure, not filthy. Beautiful, not ugly. Praise, not complaint. Excellent, not inferior. And of course, that's a whole lot easier to do when you're getting information from books or from conversations or from real life experiences than it is when you're online, inundated with all of these things. So, obviously problematic, and I think most everybody here understands that's the case and needs no convincing. You know, it's like we may say, you know, addicted, I'm not addicted to the internet. Well, that's what every addict says, I'm not addicted. So we need to be cautious about that. But I think most people understand we need to try and control all of these kinds of activities we have, including the online kind of activities. We need to change our schedules so that we have more positive real-world activities and fewer internet activities instead of letting it escalate the other way. If, in fact, you look at your life and more of your activities and more of your interactions are online than in the real world, and that's diminishing, you're moving in the wrong direction. We began with this kind of counseling, say you need to keep a diary so that you actually know how much time that you're spending online and how much time you're spending in real face-to-face interactions. And then you need to start using some kind of external stoppers when you find yourself, you know, just kind of drug into the old habits of being online all the time. You need to have timers. You need to have appointments that are made. You need to have schedules that are going to remind you, no, I need to be doing this real life kind of activity as opposed to this virtual activity online. And probably too. It's a matter of our mindset and what we think is important. We need to set goals about how much time we're going to spend online versus how much time we're going to spend in other sort of activities. Need some reminder cards, you know, the verses, the reminders, the epigrams that are posted on your refrigerator and on your mirror. Need to have all of those kind of things as an effort to say, wait a minute, what are you doing? Instead of just drifting into the same kind of pattern of behavior that ultimately becomes more and more and more until it becomes problematic or maybe even addictive.